Board of Directors on September 13th, Wednesday, here at Plymouth United Church of Christ on Warren Avenue. Quorum call, please.
Chairperson Hendricks.
Present.
Vice Chairperson Baker.
Present.
Secretary Miller.
Present.
Director Brown.
Here.
Director Quadrelli.
Here.
Director Zen.
Here.
Members, you've had an opportunity to review the agenda. Pretty short and concise. If there are no questions, I'll entertain a motion to approve the agenda as submitted.
Move approval of the agenda for today's meeting.
Second.
Moved and supported. All in favor?
Aye.
That motion passes. Next item is approval of the minutes for the August 23rd Board of Directors meeting.
Motion to approve.
Support.
Moved and supported. No questions on the minutes of the meeting. If not, all in favor indicate by the sign of aye.
Aye.
That motion is passed. Next item on the agenda is public comment. 3 minutes per speaker. Mr. Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is the opportunity for members of the public to address the Great Lakes Water Authority. If you're in the room, you can come to the podium. And if you participate by Zoom, you can either raise your hand on the application, or if you're participating by Zoom by telephone, press star 9 on your telephone. So at this time, if there's anyone in the room that wants to come forward, and we are not seeing any hands raised, Mr. Chairman, so it's a call for public comment as well.
Anyone for public comment, either in the room or virtual?
Still no hands up, so a third and final call to me.
Anyone for public comment, either in the room or virtual? Seeing none, hearing none, we'll close that portion of the agenda. Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Next item on the agenda is communication. Do we have any correspondence? There are none according to the agenda. Moving on to old business, there is none. And that takes us to new business and the reason that we're here today. This is a presentation, budget and charges briefing, September 2023. Ms. Nicolette Bates, you got the floor.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for having a meeting today. It's the time of the year where we're working on budget, and there's several key matters that we really want to advise you of, consult with you on as we move into our FY 2025 fiscal year planning. I do want to, just before we start, give my appreciation to the team from Public Affairs today, Debbie, Keith, Curtis, Brent, and Jason. It's a heavy lift for our team to set things up at this alternate location, and we always appreciate your support in doing this, in addition to your extra time with us today. So our presentation today is in two parts. You might remember last November, we presented a report to you on the Economic Outlook Task Force. When we saw tremendous changes in the economy that was impacting our costs on a very rapid basis, we assembled a team of national experts in economics, construction sector, supply chain, and formed the Economic Outlook Task Force. They presented their first report to us last November, and since then they've presented quarterly updates to the Audit Committee. One of the desired outcomes of that initial report was some forecast planning scenarios. So different assumptions might have different levels of impacts. So we kind of had a pessimistic, optimistic, and somewhere in between forecast scenario in terms of percentages over the next 5 years to help us better understand what we need to potentially be prepared for both operating and capital costs. So in your packet today, the first thing that we're going to turn to is the Economic Outlook Task Force update. And the public sector consultants has a team that we work with on a regular basis. Nick Curry, who is the lead, unfortunately he is had to choose between us or celebrating his wedding anniversary today. And we think he chose appropriately. But working very closely with him and really pulling the report together for us with the details for review with Nick is Ben Fulton. For technology reasons today, Ben is not able to join us via Zoom, but he is actually on my phone and he is going to walk us through this presentation in that way. Then we will, when you're ready to, right now we have, I'm not sure if you can see us on Zoom.
We have
your cover page shown, and the public affairs team is going to advance the slides. So just say next when you're ready to go to the next page.
Sounds great. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Excellent. Well, thank you for the introduction. And again, apologies I'm not there with you in person. I'm happy to be on stage at the moment. But as Nikki mentioned, I'm Ben Fulton. I'm a senior consultant at Vector Consultants. We're a Lansing-based public policy research and consulting firm that provides a wide range of services, including this type of work, to nonprofits, public sector agencies, associations, and all kinds of other groups. So it's a real pleasure to be with you all this afternoon, even though it's not in person. So, I think we can go to the next slide here, and I'll jump right into the presentation. Excellent. I can see we're on the next slide, so perfect. Thank you. So I'm going to just start with this overall executive summary slide. As Nikki mentioned, we've been providing quarterly updates, but want to provide a kind of overall look as we get into some of the more specific details later in the presentation. So I want to start with just a conversation here about inflation. So as anybody that's paying attention or just looking at their pocketbook over the last couple of years, inflation has been a major issue and created a lot of challenges both for individuals and families, but also businesses, organizations trying to plan for their future spending. So as we are seeing in the data, including some just released this morning, inflation has been much more stable in 2023 than it was in 2022. That said, as many of you may know, inflation was hovering around 2% or lower for a long period of time leading up into the pandemic, where we saw major spikes in 2020, 2021, and 2020, cooling a little bit into 2022, but still relatively high. So, last year we were sitting at about 7% inflation year over year. So end of the year 2022 into end of year 2023, we're hovering right around 7%. And right now, the kind of year-over-year look from the analysis just from this morning is that we're hovering right around 4% since the beginning of this year up until now. So anyone that's been watching market stuff this morning knows that the inflation report was released, and that the year-over-year from August of 23 back to August of 2022 is at 3.7%. So that climbed a bit from 3.2% between July of 22 and July 23, excuse me. And so that's good news in an aggregate sense that we're down from 7% down into the numbers that start with a 3 or a 4. But as any analyst would probably tell you right now, getting from 7% to 3.5% to 4% is likely going to be a lot easier than getting from 3.5% to 4% down to the 2% Federal Reserve target. There's likely likely going to take quite a bit of action to continue moving us in the right direction there. That decline up from 7% down to closer to 4% has been primarily driven by reductions and reversals and trends related to food prices, oil prices, and then the kind of fixing of a lot of supply bottlenecks that were associated with a lot of pandemic issues. So a lot of those things have been helpful in getting us from 7 down to 4, but the analysis today is showing that, a creep back up in energy prices is resulting in, the kind of stalling of that decline as we hover right around that 3 or 4% number and not quite down to that 2% number. So I know I've been throwing a lot of percentages and things around, and unfortunately that's going to continue here on the next bullet. So our inflation forecasting work, as Nikki mentioned, is something that we've been working on over the last, really almost 2 years. And so we continue to update our forecast with data as it becomes available and, buy those projections on a regular basis. So So in June of 2023, with the data we had, we were projecting a 12-month end of year 2023 inflation rate at about 4.2%. Based on the data that we have that's been updated since June, our forecast is showing a number of about 3.6%. So that would be, you know, end of year 2023 compared to end of year 2022 at around 3.6% with that updated data. A couple notes to also include from a kind of national, international perspective, as many of you heard about and read about, and there were several, you know, concerning bank failures earlier in this year that created some uncertainty in markets and the broader economy. Those issues, among others, have created some, you know, risk for recession. Although, you know, the economy remains relatively strong, unemployment is low, and speaking of unemployment, low unemployment combined with inflation is continuing to put pressure on a lot of industries, including construction. As we all know, you know, whenever there is a, you know, a potential downturn in the economy, or as we've seen with inflation, construction is one of the first industries that's hit really hard. Folks start to pull back spending. There starts to be concern about a lot of supply side issues, material costs, labor costs. And so we're seeing that in Southeast Michigan, across the state, across the country, really. And speaking of that, you know, construction bids, you know, we're hearing in Southeast Michigan and across the state remain high, and it's likely that those costs will continue to remain high. You know, the research literature on this suggests that these prices, these bid prices, are often quick to rise as contractors try to account for rising costs on their end. And so they're quickly trying to adjust and make sure the bid that they're putting in now, that is for money they will receive later, will actually give them enough money to complete the project, pay their workers, buy the materials they need. So that's why those bid prices just start to climb really quickly as inflation grows. Unfortunately, they're often slower to come down. Lower unemployment, higher wages, rates for workers, and the broader economy. But in terms of bid prices, they're going to create some challenges. Those labor costs being elevated and result in, you know, those being stickier and taking a little bit longer to come down, even as material prices start to come down. So that's my last bullet on this slide, is that, and I'm going to go into material costs in the next couple slides, so I'm going to go ahead and advance to the next one here. Okay, so we're looking at three charts here, you know, in ever-increasing, smaller kind of time horizons. So as you'll see on the far left of the screen here, this is a 20-year look at a basket of construction materials. So, you know, collection of different materials that are, you know, required to do a lot of construction projects. And we're looking at an index that tries to measure the change in the prices that producers of these materials are paying. Consumers on the back end, people who are buying these materials, do stuff with them. So I just want to note quickly, the far right table there, or the far right chart there, is from a y-axis, a vertical axis there. We're much more zoomed in, so the numbers there climb in, you know, numbers of, you know, five point increases there as you go up the scale, whereas in the left two graphs, we're looking at much larger increases. So I just want to make sure people pay attention to that, and that's clear. So as you can see, over the 20-year trend, we have a massive spike in 2021, 2020 and 2021, leading into, you know, all the way into 2023. And then as we zoom in a bit closer, we look at the five-year horizon, you can kind of see these prices really spike during 2020, 2021, and into 2022. And then what we're seeing over 2023 is, you know, a little bit more stability, you know, like we may have plateaued, but little ups and downs. And that's what you can see on the graph on the far right. As you can see, you know, there has been, you know, a drop, you know, since July of 2022 into the start of 2023. But the start of 2023 brought a new kind of rise back, and then things are starting to kind of go back down again. So just important to remember that even when, you know, the chart on the far right or even the one in the middle starts to dip down, we are still way above the trend over the previous 20 years. So even if the, you know, the cost hopefully today is a little cheaper than it was, you know, a month ago. We're still, even that cheaper price is still way above where we would have expected it to be in, you know, July of 2019. That trend looks relatively stable and all of a sudden there's a huge spike. So just an important point with inflation that made it really challenging. Prices are really quick to rise, even when they come down, you're still way above where you were before. So let's jump to the next slide. So in addition to looking at, you know, a basket, a collection of materials, it's also important to look at individual materials that are really important to GLWA and its contractors. So as you can see, between July 2013, July 2020, you know, relatively stable prices across a lot of these really important commodities. And again, looking at the prices producers are paying, until, again, no surprise here, major jump in 2020 and 2021 in particular, iron and steel and chlorine, really important materials for both capital and operating projects. And then in 2022, around the beginning of the year, toward the middle of the year, prices start to come down for these materials. And again, like I just said, even where those prices have come down, you know, we're looking at chlorine down around 12% over the last year, it's still way higher than it was, you know, in 2019, and higher than you would have expected it to be if you were just looking at the last 10 years of trend data. So that's the story on iron and steel pipes and tubes, as well as chlorine. And then if you look at those next four, aggregates, cement, electrical equipment, things like that, those saw, maybe a little bit more slower increase, but those increases have continued. And they really haven't, maybe they slowed, you see little plateaus in there, but they still up year over year, whereas some of these other materials were down year over year. So just an important thing to keep in mind as we're thinking about, the last slide that shows a lot of these things together, and then kind of breaking it apart and looking at some of the more individual components in here. So perfect. Now let's talk about another key component of any project. You know, we all know material prices are really important, but so are wages. And this is a look at full compensation across all private industries in Detroit, the Midwest, and then the United States for a comparison. So again, an important thing to look at on the vertical axis here, these are the rates of either increase or decrease, in these cases increase. In total compensation, we're talking wages, salary, benefits, retirement, all those things kind of put into one. As you can see, over the last 5 years, for the first 3 years of that, relatively stable with these costs kind of going up about 2 to 3% per year, kind of looking back. And then all of a sudden, 2021, these increases start to increase pretty dramatically. In fact, by the time we get to the end of the year last year, we nearly doubled the rate at which these wages are increasing. So not that wages and compensation doubled, but the rate at which they are increasing doubles. And so, those rates at which wages have been increasing has started to decline, but we're still above the kind of trend, in the first half of this chart. So just an important thing to keep in mind. If we were to see, actual wage decline in here, you'd have to look at the bottom of this graph, which is at 0%. So that's just an important, thing to keep in mind here. And not much difference between what's going on in Detroit, the Midwest overall, or the United States as a whole. They're all pretty close by the time we hit June of this year. It is released on a quarterly basis. So let's jump to my last slide here, and then I'll pause for questions. We can turn to any of the other slides that I've covered so far. So as I mentioned, 2019, 2020, even if we that further, we're looking at inflation rates at 2% or lower. And so all of a sudden, when we hit 2021, those rates jump. We're at 4.7% in 2021. Depending on the measure you're using, we're somewhere between 6.5% and 7%, and 7.5% at the end of 2022. And that's where we have to start making projections. And so as Nikki mentioned, we're looking at an optimistic case in the green. So lots of different factors could be included in that as to why inflation might reduce faster than we expect. We're looking at a pessimistic case on the red, where rates stay, these inflation rates elevated longer. And then the base case, what we're, kind of the general consensus, this is where we're expecting things to fall. In our 2022 projections, we fell just within this kind of blue bar, and we're hoping that'll be the same in 2023 from, an analytical perspective, but obviously hope for, the economy's sake that inflation goes more into that green bar there. So as you'll see, as I mentioned earlier in the presentation, we're projecting around 3.6% by the end of this year for year-over-year inflation rate. And then we're seeing, a continued decline into 2024 and the out years. As you'll see in this blue bar, though, we're not projecting at this point, again, when you're in the tenths of percentages here, it's important to keep in mind that the kind of light blue around the blue bar that kind of shows some range there, that we're talking about rates that still could be above the 2% Fed target in the out years. That said, our optimistic scenarios see inflation rates declining in, just below the target into 2024 and remaining where they were around 2019 and before. That's a super optimistic case. If you're reading a lot about this issue, you often find that folks are, very concerned that it's going to be difficult to get all the way back down and below 2% over the next 5 years. So I'm going to stop there and happy to answer any questions, and we can flip back to any slides that are related to those questions.
And before that, if I could just point out a few things. So team, if you could go back to slide 4, please. Thank you. So one of the things that you're going to hear us talking about, that we talked about last year when we first did this report and talked about our outlook, is when the regional authority was formed, those conversations were playing out in 2014, 15, our effective date was 2016. And we did a feasibility forecast at that time. Clint Moran provided that report to both the DWSD and GLWA boards, a feasibility for the regional authority and the reasonableness of the 4% promise that our budget wouldn't increase any more than 4%. And so when you look at these slides, we can see the era in which that decision was made, things were put, that was our reality. And it had been that way for quite a while. And after having gotten past 2007-08, the latter half as we approached 2010, and then we're going into 11, 12, 13, this level of stability was our reality. The issue is we're in a different reality today that's played out over the past couple of years. So just in terms of context of where we're at with our feasibility forecast versus why are we so different, why are we feeling this pressure, that line chart tells that. And if you wouldn't mind backing up one more slide, my colleague, Chief Operating Officer for Wastewater Operations, Naveen Aram, did a really nice job for us at the executive leadership team to help understand the dynamics of our CIP. And he took a particular project, and through each CIP, as it was planned earlier, and is now moving more towards phases of bidding, design, next level design and execution, how each CIP, the project cost increases. And again, if it was a more stable era like we had in 13, 14, 15, we would be having that conversation, which is why we're kind of looking at all of our existing scenarios through new lenses. And what this really points out is I would not want to be a construction contractor estimator in this environment because in my prior public accounting life, over half my client base was construction contractors. And the estimators were really the ones who made the money for the business, because either they set the bid prices at a good price or not so good. And it would have been very hard for anybody to have foreseen the impacts of the economy on this. So while we see bids coming in, we're also recognizing the stress that the construction sector has been under and continues to see, and the strategies that we talked about when we presented the Economic Outlook Task Force report last year in terms of looking at packaging our projects differently, perhaps buying supplies differently, supply chain, getting materials is a big issue. So, you know, all of these things play into, you know, some pretty serious issues that we're faced with today. Again, we're always going to manage through and work through these, but they are significant, and it's not, the tide isn't going to change very quickly. So with that, those are my comments. That was Ben's report. Any questions for Ben?
Questions for any? I don't see anything.
Okay. All right. Well, Ben, thank you very much. We're dialing in today. I'm going to log off the call, and I will talk to you later.
Thank you, Ben.
Sounds great. Thank you all so much.
All right. So with that, we'll move to the next presentation document in your binder. And I'll put my phone over there so I don't drop it somewhere. And that is a briefing on budget and charges. And the first slide just kind of gives an overview of the timing. You know, this is a large organization, $800 million plus annual budget, rolling $1.5 billion or more. Capital improvement plan. And all the contracts that come before you that you're awarding, they're multiple large dollar contracts. So how do we build in agility, nimbleness, and resiliency for an organization that is this large? And it comes down to planning, scenario planning, and understanding what our challenges are so that we can work through them. So that's why we're having this meeting with you today, our Board of Directors meeting, to receive the Economic Outlook Task Force update, as well as a briefing on budget and charges. We annually have what we call our charges rollout meetings. Charges rollout number one is October 19th, and that is where the full capital improvement plan document version one is presented. The timing of this meeting really works out today because yesterday we had our board capital planning committee. And at that meeting, the capital planning board members received a briefing on where we're at in terms of aligning the CIP with the 10-year forecast that we've been working through. In November, we meet for units of service. That really, units of service is how we divide up the budget pie. So CIP is an input into the budget, units of service, technical analysis presented at that meeting. Internally, we try to put pencils down November 30th to compile proposed budget and charges documents to present to the audit committee in December. And that's really the first time the board sees the CEO's proposal as it relates to the budget that we have compiled and prepared, as well as what all of this is looking at in terms of charges to member partners. Going on to the next slide, then January, a big month for us. Charges rollout number three is when we meet with our member partner communities and present the proposed charges, walk through those, talk about the proposed budget, how that ties to charges. Then we have a series of one-on-one meetings with our member partners, where they can meet with members of our team to walk through their charges worksheets individually, understand how the budget works, how their charges work. And then we regroup for one final meeting, charges rollout number four in January, where we report out on our one-on-one meetings, the types of questions folks have, if there's anything that we think needs to be tweaked based on that feedback, and further review of the budget. In January, we do present the budget to the board as well. That prepares us to move forward to a board meeting in February, where we conduct the public hearing and potential adoption of the budget with an effective date of July 1st, so we're July 1 fiscal year. Next. So today, we want to talk to you about some strategic matters. In terms of the budget, again, unprecedented budget constraints. Because many of our contracts are 3 and 5 year contracts, we had contracts that we were entered into pre-COVID where we were able to control those costs So sometimes for us, there's a delayed pop-up of costs because we have prices locked in. Now we're going back to the market. And since we can, we do have the conversations with vendors about holding their prices, and at times have brought to you, I think, some extensions related to that. So we have one more year of the 4% promise, FY 2025. That means our budget increases no more than 4%. How that relates to our member partner charges overall is typically, you can expect, that if our budget increases 4%, if we have some offsets like investment earnings, then it'll be some amount less than 4%, which has generally been our history. So the long-term course, and we're gonna provide analysis today to explain how we get to making this statement, is to really correct over-delivery of the 4% promise. And a lot of it is the focus on the capital needs of the system, the level of deferred maintenance, and we're also doing all the right things by the various studies on needs assessment, condition assessment, but what happens when you determine something needs to be addressed? It's not always an option to not address it in our world. With that, we still see that we can largely not a huge variation from what we presented to you last November, but largely we still think we can return to our long-term plan objectives by year 10 of this forecast. Because our numbers are too big. The commitment to the 10-year forecast is something that is applauded by rating agencies, analysts, and others. And because we're so big, every decision you make is not a one-year decision, other than maybe setting charges. All the contracts, budget documents, bond issuances are all long-term decisions. And then just be mindful, we have to not just look inward, but look outward. What around us impacts us, the economy, the cost of maintaining and replacing infrastructure, our financial as well as operational and resiliency, and frankly, the increased competition for low-cost SRF loans. The intended use plan was just issued by the state of Michigan for water this week, wastewater, sewer a few weeks ago, and those documents are subject to public hearing, but it basically telegraphs who's going to get the low-cost SRF loans. Our state is taking on lead service line replacement. That's a high priority for public health and safety. Impacts a lot of disadvantaged communities, so those score high points on awarding projects. So while GLWA has in the past enjoyed state revolving fund dollars, there is increased competition that is facing us. In terms of charges, Bart Foster is here with us today. Our charges consultant from the Foster Group is also going to talk about, we have just really one or two slides on unique things upcoming for this year's charges. So going on to the next slide, in terms of the near-term issues to address, I've talked about the 4% promise. I'm going to give you some examples so that you can see what we're facing in terms of our operations and maintenance budget. Our capital spend rate assumption. So in our earlier years, it was a new organization, and I think this might have been discussed at yesterday's capital planning committee, that there was just underspending. We didn't have project managers here to run projects, and so the CIP spend in our early years was as low as 34%. Now we're doing what we're supposed to be doing, which is delivering capital to maintain the system appropriately, and that means our capital spending. In those early years, when it was 34%, 46%, I needed a way to translate from what we, our gut instinct on, from a financial perspective, on what we thought the organization was going to be able to deliver for all of these dynamics compared to a financial plan. Because if we bonded and built a financial plan based on 100% delivery in those days, we would have overborrowed, we would have spent a lot of money on interest expense that we needed to. So we needed a way, and then, you know, frankly, as a general rule, GLWA is excelling its peers. It's not uncommon to see most utilities delivering at about 80% of their capital plan, because there's a lot of project interdependencies, timing issues, other things that occur. So you know, so we kind of thought normal state would be 75% to 80%. So we've gone from low delivery to now on-pace delivery, particularly as we're moving into construction phases. Those are hard dollars. It's not like engineering where it's lower, softer dollars. It's hard dollars, and that spend occurs quickly. And, you know, once you have a project going, you don't stop it. So last year I talked about entering an era of belt tightening. We're now in an extended era of belt tightening. We still have hanging out the Highland Park issue. We're in mediation. Always hopeful that we will be reaching a conclusion with that soon. And then, like I said, we'll talk about some dynamics related to sewer shares. So on the next slide, just talking about our long-term forecast and how it plays out. So managing our cash is very important. So the cash flow, tying the cash flow to our investment returns, to issuing debt. So you inherited one of the largest, most highly leveraged utilities in the country in terms of outstanding debt. So our mission has been to bring down our debts. Almost 50% of the budget on a daily basis goes to debt service. So how do we bring that down? So we had a strategy during 2016, 17, 18, 19, where we had budget savings into 2020, where we built up our reserves. And then we entered the era where return on investments was 1%, because the economy was much different than it is today. And so that's when we spent down those capital funds. And we really had like a holiday for 2 years. Other than state, low-cost state revolving fund loans, we kind of had a holiday for about 2 years on issuing debt. So when I look at, you know, where we started to where we're at, in terms of our debt service, we haven't decreased our outstanding debt, but we haven't increased it. We've done a lot of capital improvements in the meantime. And that's through managing this pay-as-you-go as part of a balanced strategy utilizing debt. We are now down to what I would say our minimum. Previously, we established $90 million as a minimum in our improvement and extension funds. Given the cost escalation, $90 million doesn't buy today what it bought 5 years ago when we set that target. So we're revisiting some metrics to reevaluate what our minimum should be. So going on to the next page, we also want to highlight, I mentioned the increased competition for SRF projects. And we've been, again, in the past, really enjoyed generally getting the projects awarded that we applied for. But that's not the case now. So this year, there's seven projects on this list. We applied for $481 million worth of projects. The draft IUP, that's the intended use plan, that the state recently issued. It looks like they, pending any changes, are looking at award amounts of $252 million with grant and principal forgiveness of $20 million, so a net of 211. But the point is we've applied for almost $500 million and got about 250. So about 50% of what we applied for. So, the other thing I wanted to point out on this slide, let's see, so you'll see projects, so you'll see some yellow highlights. So the other thing, when we talked about cost escalation and estimating costs, is you'll see, for example, project 212008, the WRF, Water Resource Recovery Facility, Aeration Improvements 1 and 2. That project, at the time we did all the applications, the public hearing work, for the SRF, it was at $90 million. This project came in at $196 million. We got bids in April. And I would leave it to Naveed to give the detailed explanation. And so, of course, when we saw bids come in, it's like, oh, well, those must be inflated, surely. And Naveed and our procurement team have had many, many meetings with the contractor. And I think for me, a lesson in this is, because of the age of our infrastructure, when they're doing a project, there might be other elements of the project. In this instance, it includes the foundation, so new equipment, But I'm doing the Jane Citizen explanation, so Naveed, feel free to kick me out of the way, please. It is, the contractor said, well, Naveed, do you really want to put all this new equipment on this old of a foundation? And you saw in the public sector consultants report the cost of cement increases. So there's things like that. When we're replacing our assets, they're old assets, sometimes you don't know until you get into these things. And we have our engineer's eyes, but then you bring in the contractor's eyes, they also look at things differently because they, you know, they're doing the construction work. And so this is thrown, and this is why we're meeting with you so early, frankly, is because how do we bring this project to you with this $106 million delta without talking about where we're at with the long-term forecast? So we received bids in April, the contractor's been working with us, it's holding their prices, but they're anxious to get a go, no go. And so again, that's, you know, part of the driver of us chatting today. The Fruitwood Pump Station, again, when we applied, we thought the project would be about $86.8 million. The revised estimate this month is at $125 million. And pump station number two, bar rack replacements and grit collection system improvements, the SRF application was for $98 million, which, you know, is a document that's really less than a year old, and now we're looking at $110 million. So again, you know, these are real live examples to back up, you know, what we're talking about and the challenges that we need to work through. Naveed, any cleanup you want to do on what I said?
I just want to make one note on these estimates as well, and I thought the forecast really spoke to it. What we notice in these cost estimates, because of our projects, they're not one-year turnaround projects, they're not two-year turnaround projects, they're 7 years, 5 to 7 years. And what tends to happen is the contractor will do escalation, and they sometimes apply it to the middle of that year because they can't procure everything the first day, right? So they're buying copper later in the project life cycle. They're buying steel later in the project life cycle. So they're also escalating based on these factors. And this is very conservative numbers. We're seeing ranges between 5 to 6% that they're applying to their cost estimate just to be able to escalate a 7 year project life cycle. So a lot of these numbers, our estimators are doing it, but we're missing the mark. And we're seeing the areas where these cost increases are experienced, mostly equipment, electrical equipment being a big one, concrete is another one. So those are the factors that play a major role in these estimates that we're seeing deltas between what was the engineer's estimate versus what the contractor's estimates are. Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Yes. Maybe, yeah. Are these low bid contracts?
These are low bid contracts.
So when they bid the contract, they want the contract based on low bid.
The constructor are low bid contracts. That is correct.
And then, are you concerned that you have other contractors that didn't win the bid, and now you're willing to increase the cost to a price that may be higher than some of the other contracts that didn't win?
Can you say that one more time? And I want to make one clarification on the low bid portion.
We're concerned at DWSD that if we increase the price on a low bid contract, that there's some liability with the contractors that did not win.
That is correct. So these are, just for clarification, the numbers that are shown that we went to SRF for, those are opinion probable construction costs. So those are their engineers' estimates. That's what we have as a tool before we go out to advertise, as the number that it is, what we assume is going to be the cost of construction. What you see in the highlights, the top one is a bid that's received, and that's a design builder, so it's not 100% low bid. That one is a qualified base bidder. But the other two, those are just updated opinion probable costs. So from the time the construction package was built, but there's a time that it takes for us to go out on the street. We had our engineers go back and give us a new opinion of probable cost. So what you see in the highlighted for Fruit and Bar Rack and Grid, those are still estimates. We still haven't received hard bid numbers, but you're absolutely right. After we receive hard bid numbers, we're not adjusting our number. Then at that point, it's the fact. That's what the cost to build it is. And unfortunately, the first one that we have received so far is Air Vision Deck 1 and 2, and it has doubled in cost.
And does your engineer estimators have an idea of what the profit margin is on the contract?
To some extent, they do. They make their estimates of what those margins are, but I don't think they are anything outside of what they used to be, right? This is what we're hearing, is that the margins are the same, the amounts change because the dollar amounts change, but nothing
else. But maybe the contractor has to take a haircut on the profit margin until we get costs back in line. That's something that we negotiate, that we, other than coming and asking for more money, let's both parties take a haircut.
So when we're in a situation like this, we bring in other resources that we have. We have ADCOM that we're under contract with, as well as PMA. And we both have contracts with them to help us work through value engineering and other design, and then bringing in their independent evaluation of cost. So this is something where we're fortunate that we have a suite of other professionals, resources, databases that we bring to the process. I'm not sure if there's other things that you do as you're vetting through this process before we would even think about bringing it to the board.
Absolutely. So I think those are phases, right? Those are phases of negotiation. So as Nikki indicated, so the first thing I have done for the Aeration Deck 1 and 2 is I send that back to the engineering estimating team. And this is one of the largest firms in the country. And they're doing estimates, and it's a very detailed estimate that they provided us that was so different than what they provided. I'm asking them, and we are putting the pressure on to why do we have this variance? What is causing this variance? And unfortunately, it's so unstable that that is a very common conversation that you have with the estimator that says, well, this is what we assume. This has significantly changed over a 6-month period, over a year period. There has been such fluctuation.
Yeah.
Then, after we figure out the scope, after we figure out the validity to the dollars of the assets, then we get to the soft costs, which are, you know, what is the overhead and profit, and is there room to really negotiate some of those? Unfortunately, as you know, with some of the low bid numbers, we really can't negotiate too many of those items because of the way that the bidding process is. But it is something that we work with, we engage appropriate firms to be able to assist us to make sure that we're getting the most fair and equitable cost for our projects.
Yeah. Do you want to address why design build and why that makes sense for a public project like this to be able to control costs?
Absolutely. So I think for this specific project, so we delivery methods, right, are very applicable to the demand of the project. In this specific case, there was a lot of unknowns with respect to what's inside the tank and how we could deliver it. When we drop a tank, it's a major operational change, and you could run into costs and associated with dropping a tank, inspecting the tank, designing something, coming back after 2 years of design and finding that the condition changed and therefore the cost has now increased. So we, in this application, it made a lot of sense for us to do design build because they're dropping the tank, the contractor sees the condition, they quickly can turn around and design, and they can start putting shovel in the ground a lot sooner before additional deterioration happens that could become a liability to us. So we look at every project and the delivery method, and the delivery method is really partnered with the type of project it is. As you all know, that we have talked about the underground project and how that was appropriate for us to do a CMR at risk, construction manager at risk. That one is a different delivery method as in design build, but it was appropriate because it's so much underground pipe.
All right, moving on. Next we are on, I believe, going to slide nine. So in terms of balancing the overall budget, things we have discretion over, how much we spend on capital, how much we build up our improvement extension fund, how much we spend on operations and maintenance, and what our revenues from charges. Again, almost half our budget is debt service. That's something you don't have discretion on. We have the lease payment. That's a fixed amount. Legacy pension, that is a predetermined amount in water residential assistance program. So those are some of the levers that we can hit and the ones that we are simply off limits. So with this, going on to the next page. And at this point, so I'm going to ask Bart Foster to join us. You know Bart as our charges consultant. And, you know, there's only a handful of us in the room who were in the room when the 4% promise and the forecast was created, along with leadership, financial leadership of the three counties, the city of Detroit, and Bart and I as the resources, we'll call it. And so we want to talk about the 4% promise, where that's at, and then Bart also serves as our feasibility consultant when we issue bonds. So when we put together an official statement, which is a legal bond offering document, we're pledging our revenues. And so what bondholders or buyers of those bonds want to know is, if I buy these bonds, is there going to be sufficient revenues to run the system as well as to pay my debt service? And so that's the other capacity that he performs for us. And that's why I've asked him to speak today as it relates to our performance and where we're going from here as we prepare for the future.
You want me to pick up here?
Yep.
Okay. Thank you, Nikki. It's good to see you all today. You can leave that slide up. I want to, and we're going to get to an update of the forecast later on in the presentation, and we're coming at it from birth, frankly, from GLWA's birth, and reminding all the stakeholders exactly what the thinking was that led into the financial deal that became GLWA. That 4% promise is what was subjected to the review by Plant Moran at the time in a lease feasibility forecast published in May of 2015. And the stakeholders wanted to know, hey, can this new regional entity afford a $50 million annual lease payment and maintain a promise to not increase its rates, its budget, by more than 4% every year for the next 9 years? And their feasibility forecasts show not only can it can do it in improved operating statistics, operating metrics. There's a chart for that later on, but the feasibility business case forecast for forming the authority was to get to this debt service coverage ratio for the system of 1.7 by year five. So they had 16, 17, 18, 19, 20. By year five, let's get to 1.7. So that's from my perspective, that's the most important metric on the fiscal health of the utility systems. So that we look at a lot of other things, but that's one thing that we're focusing on in terms of objectives going forward. Let's go ahead to the next slide, please. The notion that was put into that feasibility forecast was an assumption that the 4% would be embraced every year. And actually the GLWA had struggled to get it down to the 4%. So that's what's represented by that black line. If there'd been the 4%, full 4% budget increase every year from 2017, which is the first real fiscal year for the authority, through 2024, which is what we're in now, that would have increased the budget cumulatively by just under 37%. Decisions were made every year on individual budget increases, and you can see what has actually occurred is that the water part is at 16% and the sewer part is at 12%. So the takeaway from this slide is, had the full 4% been fully implemented every year, then the charges today to the water member partners would be 21% higher, and those to the sewer member partners would be 24% higher. Set the table with this, and then we'll come back to it when we get to the forecast later on.
We'll do next slide, Dr. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Next slide, please. And that last slide was really geared on the budget. As Nikki mentioned earlier, the budget change and the charge change are not always going to be the same. There have been some years where we had a budget change of 2%, but it required a 3% charge increase because investment earnings were in a tailspin. So we had a negative variance on what we thought we could get from non-charge sources. And therefore, the charge increase had to be higher than the budget increase. The opposite happened last year in 2024. We were able to achieve a 4% budget increase, but only had to increase charges by 2.75%. Because we were recognizing the availability of enhanced investment income. So we just wanted to summarize recent history of what the actual charge adjustments have been and then a 7-year average of roughly 2% for water and less than 1% for sewer. So we just wanted to set the table with that, and we'll return to it when we get to the forecast.
Great. Thank you, Bart. So next we're going to go through some details on operating expenses. And going on to slide 13. So what we're comparing on this chart is something in a different way than we normally show it. So going back to 2020, we're showing what our actual budget is. So as you know, during the year we amend the budget. So as we see fluctuations, but you know, part of the question is, well, what were our assumptions and what do we think the year was going to look like when we started out? So this chart shows, and the dark blue line is the actual approved budget where we thought we started the year. So 2020 and 21, not so bad. Wound up spending in our operating expenses a little bit less than we had started out, which is good, because any excess then goes into the improvement extension fund to help offset capital increases. FY 2022, again, that was largely level. As we got into FY 2023, that was when we really began to see, and again, part of this, even though the pandemic was playing out before that, that's when those chemical contracts were coming up, and that's when we were really starting to see. So we had started off the year at about $329 million, and then ended the year with nearly $361 million. So over $30 million in operating expenses increases, and I'll show you the details of that. Then moving into 2024, that's the fiscal year we're in. So by September 1st, I already had a list from the team of budget amendments that we're going to be bringing to the audit committee this month for the first quarter, again for chemical and utility cost increases. Just doing a little bit of a deeper dive on the next slide, moving from all operating expenses to looking at commodity costs. So this is chemicals, utilities, and sludge disposal. Yesterday, I apologize, I wasn't able to sit through the entire capital planning committee meeting. I was in and out a little bit for multiple reasons, but I heard Director Brown give a nice explanation of flocculation and how that works, and taking all these little particles, aggregating the bigger particles as we process to get to our clean drinking water, but the particles that have coagulated, they're in basins, tunnels, and different processes, but both water and sewer system have sludge disposal. Scooping out that sludge and hauling it away, very expensive. And really even pre-COVID, we started to see some cost increases that have just continued to escalate. So you can see back in 2020, our initial budget was $89.6 million, and landed at $87. Yay, that's a nice, small, positive variance. But then as we moved into 2023, we're in the process of closing the books for 2023, it was $38 million of increase in 1 year. Not quite 50%, but pretty close. And as we're entering this first few months of this year, we're continuing to see cost increases. The next slide is focusing just on electricity costs. Again, every year, even going back to 2020, we are seeing increases. Again, going from $40 million in 2020 to, we're at, looking at this year, $48 million with the intel that we're getting. We do have a team, a cross-functional team, engineering, director of resiliency, director of energy management, members of financial services, who really kind of created their own internal task force on our utility costs and what we can do to address those and better understand the rate models, where we might be the challenger rather than the challengee, as we look at the buildup of these. And it really is not usage driven, it's cost. Next page is natural gas costs. Natural gas costs are interesting because there are futures that you can get to offset that. We are in communication with you, somebody in the past, and again, the market changed significantly, and we think there's some strategies we can work to mitigate this, but I don't want to make any promises at this point. But you can see it doubled. FY 2020 actual is $5.2 million. FY 2023, $12 million. These are hard costs. They're not discretionary. They are what they are. Water costs, that is a little bit of a different scenario. And this is mostly water used in wastewater operations as part of the processing. In the earlier years, 2020, 2021, it was discovered that there were meters that weren't working. So DWC was our provider at that point, was undercharging, we were underpaying. We worked, our teams worked together to fix the meters. And you'll see some catch-up billings in FY 2022. And then now a normalized state as we're entering 2023, as well as they, like all other providers, have had some cost increases and did a cost of service study to better support the charges in that area. So again, another area of increase. And then moving on to chemical costs. Again, I've mentioned chemicals a number of times. FY 2020 actual, $14.2 million. As we're closing out 2023, $29.5 million. Yes, we've had some significant unusual weather events, but on a whole, it really is largely price-driven, not usage-driven. So that's it on the expense side. When we go to the next slide, we had a great month of May 2023, the first half of June in terms of water sales. We ended FY 2023 with a small positive performance on water sales, but as we entered the first 2 months of this fiscal year, July and August, wet, cooler weather. And for us, that has translated into a $4.4 million revenue shortfall for the water system in July and August. We did have experienced a shortfall like this in the past, a couple of years ago, and it really took the entire fiscal year until we were able to recover. So kind of unique having our fiscal year end in the middle of what could be our peak season. And so that cut off between July and August. But this is something that we'll probably be reporting to you through our monthly KPIs for several months to come, and hoping that we just have some very pleasant weather and people do a lot of gardening next spring. So that is where we're at on water revenue. And again, that will be reflected in the first quarter budget amendments. So next, I want to turn to trends in capital spending. Again, the Capital Planning Committee met yesterday. I borrowed the following two slides from that presentation, and we're going through what we call CIP alignment. So we have our 10-year forecast, and that's an update of the previous year. Generally, the tweaks might be timing of bond issues, level of SRF that might lower debt service. Because the CIP, the engineers looked at us to say, hey, what's our parameters for what, you know, what can we do? Because there's a lot more that they can do than what's in that CIP document. And I wouldn't say we have a team that has a lot of projects that are not on the needed list, particularly as we're doing more condition assessment and identifying areas where we would prefer to be placing our attention with capital spending, and to the extent that we could get grants or other funding to support that, as well as resiliency initiatives. So what was presented yesterday is when we give parameters to the CIP group, I look at it in terms of five-year tranches. So we don't get too micro of, well, you can spend 192 this year and 193 next year. It's kind of like, let's look at it as a program of doing bond transaction every 2 years. And to the extent that we can smooth it out, but don't artificially smooth things out, tell us, you know, within this period of spending for 5 years. And what's not on here is we actually do 10 years, and they do 10-year planning as well. So where we're at in terms of what we call pre-alignment with the financial plan, to give you a framework, the FY 2025-29 five-year CIP that's published for the water system is $957.6 million. The current planning scenario that we're working through as we go into next year is increased to $1,058,000. Pretty lean considering the level of cost increases that we're seeing. And again, these are largely based on estimates. One of the things that they do in the CIP document when they present it that's of interest to me is how many projects do we have in flight where there's a construction contract, how many are in design, and how many are future yet to come, how many might have SRF funding. But this is a pretty lean increase that they're working within. And that's part of our reason for initiating this conversation with you now, again, before we may bring more projects to the board to approve. We're not gonna bring you something and ask for approval the next month and say, oh gosh, now we need more money. We're telling you right now what our financial situation is before we bring things to you. Same story on the next page with the wastewater system. Again, this is a larger increase. I think Naveed may have talked about it a little bit more yesterday, but again, I think as he's identifying things in the system, you just heard about the project with a $100 million increase. This is based on what they can do. Now, when they developed this, they worked very closely also with the CEO so that any trade-offs and decisions are understood by everybody. And what you're seeing here is the final scenario that we landed on that we think we could do with. There are multiple other scenarios. And this plan where we're at, we thought struck the best balance we could strike between doing what needs to be done with always still keeping an eye on affordability. Again, steps we're taking to address cost increases. I mentioned the working group that we have on the commodities. And we're also, as we're moving into this, decoupling a little bit of the financial plan to have more of an aggregate amount rather than tying dollar for dollar to the capital improvement plan, because the CIP is getting to be very dynamic because of these things. Still in alignment, but the other thing is I have on here the O&M needs. So in all of those instances where you saw increases in costs, we were able to offset that through increased investment earnings. So that really saved us. Investment earnings really saved us. But we only have investment earnings to the extent that we have funds available to invest. That's where getting to, understanding the cash flows of these projects is very important to us as well. So if Naveed had five projects of $200 million, or one project of $196 million, that $196 million spend might occur faster and has different cash flow implications than if he's managing five projects. And the cash flow's pace of spending impacts when we borrow. So you can see there's a lot of intricacies as we work through this. So that's kind of things going on with the O&M budget and how that relates to the financial plan. And then we now want to turn to talking about the 10-year financial plan as a roadmap. This is why we need a 10-year financial plan. This is why we really need to manage to a 10-year financial plan, because none of these decisions, again, you're making is for today. I often say at our member partner meetings, decisions made decades ago impact us today. Decisions we're making today are going to impact future generations. We issue 30-year bonds, the condition of our capital improvements. We have a team that's facing now deferred maintenance. With nobody's fault for a number of reasons, financial resources being among those, historically, always a challenge. So on the next page, just want to talk about briefly our water and sewer bond ratings. And again, this is important to us because bond ratings are a driver of what our cost of borrowing is. And we are very transparent with our rating agencies and bondholders. We meet with them regularly. And that's why we put out the extensive packets that we do in the audit committee, monthly reports. And, you know, I just want to point out on the left side of this is the underlying debt is the DWSD debt that was assumed by GLWA. You'll see on here the line drawn in July 2013. If you look to the left of that, that's where the predecessor DWSD was. When there was a threat, even though we had sufficient resources and excellent debt service coverage, but when there was a threat of impairment to the bonds during the city's bankruptcy, we had a significant, we went into junk status for that, is what happened. And you can drop very quickly, but it's always a very slow climb back up. The rating analysts will tell you that. They'll look at us and say, you guys are doing all the right things. Keep showing us that you're doing that. We'll keep thinking about an upgrade, but keep demonstrating performance. And so I just want to put this out there to again just remind us of where we're at. We're very optimistic, and we think that we can continue to improve. But we can't lose sight of that because a dip down is not where we want to be able to, where we want to be telling our story. So I'm going to ask again to address the 10-year forecast, Bart, to come up and walk us through that begins on page 28.
Thank you, Nikki. I'll take a pause. Every time we start talking about debt service coverage, I know that most people understand what we're talking about, but it's always a good idea to remind folks. So if I take in $100 a year, and it costs me $50 just to run my operations, I have $50 left over. And the term of art is net revenue, to do whatever I want to with. First thing I gotta do is pay the people who I owe money to, pay the people that I'm indebted to. So with that $50, if I've got mortgage payments, auto payments, credit card payments, what have you, $25, that's what comes first out of my pocket before I can do anything of discretion with it. That simple example, my debt service coverage ratio, is the 50 bucks I got left after I pay my monthly bills divided by the $25 that I owe the people that lent me money. That's the simplest form of debt service coverage. It's much more complex for $1 billion a year operation, but it is the metric that we choose to look at first to try to target sustainability from a financial perspective. So what we have in front of you here that we're going to be talking about are really three different scenarios. We introduced this lease feasibility forecast that was conducted in May of 2015 that really set the business plan for the foundation of the authority. We have, going down on the slide, the February 2023 forecast, which was, it's about a 30-page document that I prepare and submit in support of the budget and charges. It was included in the budget and charge disclosure or approval of the charges and budget in February 2023. In that, a little less than a year ago, we had a similar meeting where we talked about desired objectives on debt service coverage. It had fallen below where the forecast wanted us to be, and our desired objective was to get back up to 1.5 by 2028, which was the fifth year of last year's 10-year program, and up to 1.8 by 2032-3, which was the 10th year of last year's 10-year program. That was the objective. The update we're going to talk about right now, it's the same objective. We have not changed the objective. We've tried to come up with a financial plan that gets us there. Going back up to the top, we introduced this earlier, the five-year forecast and the lease feasibility study assumed, and I'll show you the numbers here in a minute, 1.72 could be achieved by 2020, and on sewer it was up to 1.77. When we met with you last year, we said, well, we really can't meet the objectives on water without getting really big numbers, but we're going to hew to the 4% promise for 2024 and 2025, and then we're going to forecast a 6% annual increase for the rest of the study period. That's where we were in February. On sewer, we were going to hew to 4% for 2024 and 2025, and then for a short period, we had to bump it up to 5, but by bumping it up to 5, the out years, we could get to 3. I'll elaborate on the difference between water and sewer in a moment. Nutshell summary of where we are today, or where we were in the middle of August when my preliminary update was posted, is because of some of these headwinds that Nikki's introduced, it takes larger forecasted increases to make progress towards the objectives. Go ahead and go to the next slide, please. Before I get into the details on this, one thing I want to point out is, and Nikki asked about it earlier, why more need for budget increases on water than sewer? Aren't these pressures on the operating side pretty much equivalent to both systems? They're not precisely equivalent, but they're fairly equivalent on the operating side. We looked at the water and sewer capital numbers on a couple slides ago. The annual water spend targeted is about $210 million. That's over half of the annual revenue of the water system. It's like 56% of the annual revenue of the water system. So annually, however you finance it, the current capital program is requiring more than half of what you take in revenue. Now you're going to finance with a combination of debt and pay-go funds and things like that, but that's a fairly high metric. The comparable sewer metric is $180 million a year. But sewer's got a lot more revenue. It's got like $480 million of revenue a year. So it's only like 35% of the total revenue. So if somebody asks you, hey, why are we forecasting larger water increases than sewer, it's really, it's tied into the inflationary impacts, but it's the relative magnitude of the capital program as known today, as known today. So this is really busy. What I tried to do was boil down 34 pages of exhibits and narrative into a couple, three slides. And if you'll indulge me, I'm going to walk you through a little some of the history of what I'm trying to present here. That green bar, that green line, is the representation of the Plant Moran feasibility forecast from May of 2015. And they had 5 years in there, and you can see the debt service, this is water, the debt service coverage ratio growing from about 1.5 to that 1.72. My interpretation of their work was the 4% was going to continue forever, and maybe there would be additional growth in that metric, but for purposes of illustration, I've just capped it at that 1.72. What's actually happened between 2017 to 2022 is illustrated by that black dotted line. The intended growth in debt service coverage has not been achieved. Number of different inputs. One of the most primary inputs is the 4% was not pursued. And you can see at the bottom of that chart, the actual amounts, the second to last row, the actual amounts that were achieved in the water system were 4, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, just over 2, the second last one, 4, a negative, a reduction, 1%, 2.5%, 6%. So cumulatively, instead of the 4%, the average annual that we achieved through 2024 was less than 2%. Less revenue increase, less debt service coverage, those ratios declined to about 1.4, which is what we expect to report for this just finished year. When we met earlier this year and supported the 2024 budget, that's the forecast that's represented by that gray dotted line. And you can see that we didn't get, even with the 6%, the increase in the increase from 4% to 6%, we didn't get where we wanted to be in 2028, but we got there in 2033. But note the blue line is where we are forecasting today. And because of the, mostly because of the operating expense headwinds that Nikki introduced, we're starting from a lower point, which is really why what we're suggesting forecast-wise is that the first part of this forecast period needs to go up from 6% to 7.5% for water, and then the back half can be at the 6% that was documented back in February, which gets us to the target, quite frankly. Gets us to the target at the end of the 10 years.
All right, I'm sorry, the 1 through 2 in the left column, what does that represent? The 1 through...
That's the service coverage ratio. Okay. I'm sorry, yeah.
Okay.
That should be labeled that. That's such. My apologies.
That's okay.
So the other thing I'll point out here is, you know, the fourth line from the bottom, if the 4% promise was fully implemented, and you ask me today, what's been the average annual budget increase? It's a pretty simple math. It's been 4%. What's actually happened on the next line there is, you know, it's compounding. You can't just take the average, but the compounding piece is that we've basically cut that in half in the history of GLWA to date and delivered on that. What has that meant in terms of, let's go ahead and go to the next slide. What has that meant in terms of revenue to the system and charges to the member partners? That's what this is intended to show. So if you look at that blue line, that is what the annual revenue to the system would have been had we just started with the baseline in 2017 and increased it 4% through the end of the current 10-year forecast period, which is 2034, excuse me. And the, you know, the dotted line is where we will be at the end of 2024. And the gap, the since inception, the decision to implement less than the 4% promise has resulted in significant savings to ultimate customers. The number is over $300 million. It's been, charges have been lower cumulatively since inception by $300 million than they would have been had the full 4% been implemented. The right half of that chart is intended to show, hey, even with bumping up to 7.5% for the next 4 years after the last year of the 4% promise, and then moderating to 6%, those lines won't cross forecast-wise until we get out towards the end, and the cumulative savings will have continued to grow. So the amounts that member partners have been charged relative to what the intention of the lease feasibility study was will be lower by to the tune of $440 million over this 17-year period. So just...
I'm sorry, Bart, you got to do that last piece again.
Yeah, sorry. So... and it'll get easier to show when we get to sewer, but to date, on the left side of that line, customers have been charged $309 million less than they would have had we just 4%, 4%, 4%.
Through FY 2024.
Through FY 2024. Mm-hmm. This forecast assumes that we're going to do 4% in 2025. It assumes that we're going to do 7.5% for 26, 7, 8, and 9. And then it assumes we're gonna do 6% for the rest of the 10-year period. So it's gonna, that assumption is gonna get us to a point where we will actually have been higher than if we had just done 4% all the whole time. But the early part of that period still has additional savings going on. So the savings to the customers that are paying it, if you ask me, Foster, if we had done 4% through 2034, or your crystal ball is perfect and we're going to do what's in your forecast, what's the cumulative impact on charges to water member partners? It's $440 million lower than they could have expected had they just assumed that the lease feasibility forecast was going to lock in 4% forever.
Okay, so the 309, so the 4 is not in addition to the 309.
Correct.
It's just
correct.
The growth of that.
Correct.
Thank you very
my
much.
My apologies, yes. I'm going to spend less time on the sewer, but the numbers are a bit more dramatic. So let's go to the next slide. Same forecast, the debt service coverage there. And as I mentioned, the lease feasibility forecast had it to 1.77 by the time we got to fiscal year 2020. The actual delivery, remember on water, the actual annual average to date, remember on water that was 1.9, is the 1.4 figure you see in the third to last line there under 2024. So the coverage has been even lower on sewer. There are a lot of reasons for that. But the good news on sewer is that we're not starting off as, only moderately starting off at a lower point than we were a year ago. So you'll see that the growth with 5.5% for the first 4 years and then 3.5% in the out years allows us to get to the target. And if this forecast was crystal ball perfect, by the time we get to 2034, the average annual increase would be 3%. So what does that mean to sewer member partners and what they've been charged? Let's go ahead and go to the next slide. To date, that same $309 million savings on water has actually been $450 million on sewer, cumulatively. And even with this higher than 4% arc going out, those lines aren't forecasted to cross. So we're going to grow the $452 million of perceived savings up to $1.6 billion through this 16-year time frame, or roughly $100 million a year. So the elevator speech on the sewer side would be, hey, if we get to 2034, and this forecast is accurate, what does that mean to constituents in the region? On average, they paid $100 million less a year than they would have had the full 4% and embraced the entire 30. That's the perspective I'm trying to provide. I'm not trying to make an argument on supporting the forecast or not. I'm just trying to provide some perspective. There's one final slide on the forecast that simply takes the water and sewer pieces and puts them together. And I found it comforting that it went to a nice round $2 billion number. So I felt compelled to put that in. So that's kind of the executive summary of the forecast dated August 21st. We're in the process. We learned things this morning that we want to make modifications for. I don't know if you want to summarize that before we get into the charges piece.
Why don't you talk about charges and then we'll kind of do an overall wrap-up.
This will be short. The final piece of putting all the budget, you can go to the next slide, please. The final piece of putting the CIP, the financing plan, the budget, is the charges. Charges to member partners. Fiscal year 2025, which is what we're working on, marks a reset year for the sewer shares. So the people are paying today, member partner communities are paying today, their share of the system based on analysis done in 2020, which went into place for the 2022 shares. It's been locked in since then. This is a regularly scheduled reset of that. We will have at least three more years of flow contribution data to utilize, maybe four to the extent that it's available in time. And that will be plugged into the analysis to figure out, have there been material changes in member partner A versus member partner B? We don't expect those to be material. We're using long-term averages. So even if we add 3 years to what's already in there, we're using a 10-year average. So it's not going to be material. It will be different. Nobody's going to, if we go for a 4% increase, it will not be uniform 4% for every member partner. Some will be higher, some will be lower for the first time in 3 years. The other piece of that puzzle, by the way, is we've got to look at the cost drivers. The utility costs get treated differently in the shares process than the chemical costs, than the capital costs. So that'll be in there as well. As we stand here today, I don't expect that on water. Water, we just reset with the current charges. And there were material differences around the average for individual member partners. We don't anticipate that. There is a methodology work group working right now for potential methodology changes. Frankly, we're in the middle of September. I can't fathom that any recommended methodology change is going to clear the hurdles in time for us to do anything for 2025. We may have some tweaks around the edges. But my assumption is that if it's 4%, it's going to be 4% for everybody. Now, there are there are peak demand compliance issues with contracts, not just exceptions, but in general, that's the message I would leave you with today, as I expect that when we deliver, whatever the proposed increase is, it's going to be pretty uniform for all 85 member parks. 88. Thank you.
Sorry. So, I just want to so we laid a lot on you today. I so appreciate you coming here for the special meeting today for the special topic. And I know it's been a lengthy presentation. There's just a lot going on. And again, I want to be in sync with you as we have discussions with you as we move forward with other initiatives. I'm not sure at this point if we, again, we're seeking just to receive and file this report. This is kind of teeing up the budget and charges season, but it's also teeing up discussions about other capital projects and programs being brought to you. So I'm not sure if you have any questions for Bart or myself. I see Brian. Oh, your microphone came on. So, sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
There's a red light in my jump. There's like something
Angel,
on the floor here.
That was a good presentation. You and Barb and the team that put it together very, very detailed. My questions revolved around the 4% promise, and once it terminates or it's no longer the case, what could ratepayers expect to happen? And you answered that, I think, in the last couple of slides. So I didn't have a whole lot, but I'm sure my colleagues have questions that they want to ask or comments to make. So who wants to go first? Mr. Baker, the light is on.
No one's home, though. Question for Bob. It was a good presentation. I think it's helpful to highlight that we haven't done the 4%, and that's a positive. Of course, thank you for that. At this point, the customers won't. Question for Bart is on the long-term financial plan. You base it on hitting the metrics of the 2015 feasibility study. We haven't hit those metrics, and we haven't necessarily been impacted negatively on the bond rate. Why did you base that on the 2015 forecast?
So I think
I thought that was Jay's ringtone.
So I think, I'll answer that, because from a management perspective, that was what was put out there as the how we feel we'll be measured against, is this was the feasibility forecast. And I think there was expectations that the bond ratings would be higher, that our debt service coverage would be higher, that we would achieve certain things. And, you know, when I look at this through a critical side is, why aren't you there? And when we look to our peer utilities, so generally in the spring we have PFM, our financial advisors, do a benchmark analysis of us compared to other peer utilities. And so that's a question. And again, we don't want to let you down by having a slip in our ratings. We don't want to let our constituency down with a slip on our ratings or an increase in costs. And so to us, that was a goalpost that was set to meet of expectations in that forecast. So it was feasibility, but it was also, we interpreted it as expectations of what performance would be and the value that a regional authority would bring to the region to be able to control the cost of the service.
So it's not necessarily set in stone, but it was something that was out there 8 years ago.
Well, and it's benchmarking. It's like, why would you KPIs? It's a measure.
Okay. Just a couple more comments or thoughts. It certainly speaks to the need for state and federal funding for our capital.
and I know CEO and Bill are working on that, but that really does tell a story that, you know, with all the dollars that are out there, how little we've gotten directly, you know, in ARPA dollars, and certainly with the new federal bipartisan Infrastructure Act, those dollars we really have to get and make a plan, and I know there's a plan for that. On the procurement, I assume you've looked at this. Are there any strategies we can use to help bidding, you know, to reduce the uncertainty of bidders, you know, on price escalations or unknown, especially if it's 5 to 7 years that would benefit us? I'm sure you've looked at that, but that's something I'd be interested in hearing those strategies that you already have implemented to help lessen that.
Yeah. And so we are very fortunate in that, when you see our reports, we have multiple bids for very large projects. I think in this economy in particular, so most of our bids are to in-state contractors, and particularly with increased, so our contractors, just as we talked about in the utility sector, of trying to recruit employees, they're seeing the same retirements and staffing challenges. It used to be that we saw, I think, a little bit more activity from out-of-state bidders, but now their mobilization costs, because the cost of everything's increased, the mobilization to bring a crew into the state is higher. We're still enjoying seeing multiple vendors, but we do have focus groups with our vendors that we do chat with on a regular basis. We also do that via AECOM and PMA for conversations with their colleagues, what are others seeing and doing. Myself talking with my other colleagues across the country of what are they doing, and you know, this is just not unique to GLWA. You know, frankly, we're fortunate that we do get multiple bids. Our peers don't always have that situation.
Other questions or comments?
Sir Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Great presentation. I love the way the information dealt with options around cost pressures and the increase thereof. It will be constant. I think we all accept that as our new reality. But you succinctly walk through managing it through increased revenues, cover increased costs, what other options are there. The dialogue around maintaining revenues and decreasing costs, a bit more difficult, but you talk through that. The one that probably didn't get the most airtime, but I think it's most commendable, where you maintain revenue and your costs increase, which is in essence doing more with the same. That is a cost savings, although very difficult to capture it numerically. You did walk through some of the numbers on that, which is commendable. I'd like to briefly talk about the design build process. I've seen that applied in multiple industries in multiple ways. Two most common is to take RFQs and the bidding process around total costs, and also a cost plus scenario with some kinds of cost savings, sharing gains in that mix. Is there an option that's available to us? Do we use a cost plus bid, materials, etc.? Can somewhat be standardized across the bidders? There's a slight fluctuation, but once you get those heavy costs down, you get into the variable ones like labor, mobilization, etc. So a cost plus process neutralizes just a bit more. And I think it reduces some of the liability that Brother Brown spoke about earlier for a low cost bid process, which is a total bid, and if they were the lower cost bidder, then you see the contract and how it adjusts. But if it's a cost plus bid, you've got some flexibility in there. Can you talk to that a little bit in terms of if that's an option that's available or if you use it?
And I think particularly we've explored that because so many of our projects are over a period of time.
Yeah.
And so things have increased so much over time. So I think that is a strategy that we've explored with some of our different projects. Because it certainly makes sense. I think we ran into some dynamics and challenges in trying to do that.
Yeah, and I can speak a little bit more to that. So we have boundaries with specific some of the projects because of SRF right? I will say that design build projects being funded by SRF are relatively new, if you may, right? I think it's going 5-6 years where they've actually started entertaining that type of funding structure. Most of the time, traditionally, the water sector has been design, bid, build.
Total cost.
Then we started dabbling into progressive design build. Because of our project's complexities, of not necessarily knowing exactly what we need to do, there's a lot of chemistry that goes into our products, understanding what the scope of the project needs to be, we started kind of dabbling into progressive design build. Now we are in this design build environment as well, where we are currently at this point doing more guaranteed match price on the design build. So therefore we take our projects typically to the 30% design phase, and then at that point we're advertising it and getting a guaranteed match price for the project to be executed. To take it to design build cost plus, we have started talking about it. We started doing it with the CM at risk, where we were discussing potential contingency, cost sharing, if the project gets done earlier, how we would do that, and there are some just public sector challenges with respect to if you finish the job early, how do we divide a cost that wasn't actually materialized. So it is something that we have talked about, but not necessarily materialized, but it is something that we can look into to see. You know, my criteria are typically, is it state funding eligible, right? Because the state funding has become more and more stringent requirements. So we gotta make sure that is eligible, because I don't wanna lose SRF funding opportunity because of that. And then the second one will be, is it public sector?
I understand. One of the offshoots, looking at the cost plus process, is that it more oftentimes solidifies your relationships with vendors and contractors. Because you're right, a lot of organizations don't get the responses, they don't have a lot of options to choose from. But if I have a relationship with an organization with some kind of consistency in moving my equipment, my capital endeavors, etc., I'll do more frequently because you'll help cover the cost or cover them, and I can still have my profit margins in my return on assets, fairly standardized. Not always, but it does lend itself to building longer-term relationships and pull out the variation.
Which takes out some of the challenges of our, you know, competitive
bidding. That's all a small interface. Thank you.
Oh, Jay.
Two things. One, I really appreciate the extra time, and if I mind in the future about you guys taking extra time to remind me that I said this, because it is useful to just have this to focus on. Second thing, and this is kind of following up on Brian's comment, as we move forward with this, since it is sort of a goal or a target, I'd like us to think about, and particularly because you're going to be meeting with the rating agencies, kind of get a feeling of, you know, what you think they're thinking and what you think the requirement of hitting that target is. I mean, you probably don't want to come ahead and, you know, hit them straight on and ask them that directly, but as you gain information about what it's going to do, I think seeing whether or not, you know, we fell a little bit short and we're able to provide some, you know, cheaper rates or something like that, I think that's always something that we should be striving to see if there's a way to get to.
Yeah, and we can provide a synopsis to where we're at with the existing rating agency reports that we have, and during the COVID era, typically, the rating agencies have been pretty strong on the water, wastewater, utility sector. One did kind of, because of these issues are across the board, you know, they did issue kind of an, one rating agency kind of issued a warning for the entire sector. You know, I think fortunately we've gotten past that. You know, so much of our credit story when we meet with rating agencies is DWSD's performance, which has been very positive even during the pandemic. Of, you know, this, we have the same challenges. You know, affordability, rising costs, and then the collection issues and the strategies that they put in place with the Lifeline Plan and other things to mitigate that. You know, we often say there's a business case for affordability, and you know, I think they've demonstrated that. So You know, and again, I think the rating agencies do look forward to talking to GLWA to hear how we're handling some of these things. We, you know, we're dogs with a bone when we have a problem. We're not going to drop it until we have it solved or, you know, managed in the best way that we think we can. But we can put together a synopsis of what, particularly from PFM's perspective, since they work with so many other utilities, what our peers are doing and their rating agency reports versus ours. And really, I think overall, they're rating analysts, so they're trying to manage risk. And so they're looking for consistency and positive performance.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Yeah, just a couple of things, Chair, and I almost hate to do it since I was late. So Nikki, what was the dollar value of what we were paying to the pension system for the first 10 years, the same period of time that the 4% was locked in?
Yeah, so that was $45 million in total between DWC and GLWA for pension costs and annual administrative expenses.
Okay, so yeah. We do have to make a pension payment, but we don't have to make a $45 million.
Correct. So the latest actuarial has brought that down to where they're showing, based on the 2022 actuarial, that we might have a surplus. So at that point, then it'd be the $4 million a year in administrative costs. We are going to be having a conversation with the pension system because we've built up a prepaid to see, we might still recognize that expense, but maybe get some cash flow relief on that. And that is, the decreased pension payments are reflected in these forecasts. Yeah.
I guess you made a statement earlier to an answer to one of Brian's questions that we don't want to disappoint our constituents. Are you referring to the 122 communities that are in Gleaver? Are you referring to the residents that pay the rates within Gleaver?
I'd say our entire service area and anybody else who relies on it.
Which one? Are we talking about residents, or we don't, because they don't really care about bond rating. They care about how much we raise their rates every year. That's what they really care about. And I haven't been able, I don't think I've been able to go get to 4% since I've been here. I know I'm not going to get over 4% while I'm here. And I'm being honest, based on the level of disadvantaged communities within Cleveland. On one hand, we say that we only were able to get $250 million out of $500 million that we applied for, but we got the $250 because we were able to convince the state that we have so many disadvantaged communities. A part of the application requires that we're addressing disadvantaged communities. And so when we're raising rates, we certainly have to take disadvantaged communities and what they can afford to pay into consideration. And our bond rating has steadily gone in the right direction. May not have gone where we forecasted it as fast as we have, but it has gone up. And so, I just want to make that point that there are other ways other than raising rates in order to get to where we want to go. We talked the other day about $50 million that didn't get spent in bond proceeds for capital programs at ratepayers. Ratepayers pay for that $50 million. We can talk about how many employees that we budget that aren't actually on the payroll. Ratepayers pay that. And so I would like to hear some other methods of getting to where we need to be over the next 10 years without raising rates above 4%, because I was there when we created the 4% promise. It was never a cap on it for me. It was always going to be forever So Detroit had two votes on this board, so it's not, you know, it's not going past 4%.
Brian?
I'm sorry, you know, it's not going past 4%. As long as we have the level of poverty, because these are people that have to pay the increase of these rates. So let's, and I said this the other day, and I said it again, and I sincerely mean it. If you have the 18, I might have said it about another part of Cleveland, but when you talk about Burke and you talk about the folks that are investing our bond dollars, PFM, and your team, you can do it. I know we can do it. So I'm not saying that I can't get the 4%, but I'm saying I want to hear other options other than the one that we forecasted from 10 years ago. We're continuing to ride that. And I'll leave it there. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, and I just say, you know, we don't take the 4% as a ceiling, and I think that's why you see in the sewer forecast of the later years, we return to 3.5. We, you know, we take keeping the cost down as low as we can, and that's part of having a forecast discussion is to look at different scenarios and understand the implications of those. You know, so what we presented to you today is one scenario. There are other options. Again, we thought it best met the sweet spot of where we are today. You know, again, if we get an influx of federal dollars, that would make a huge impact.
Other questions? Mr. Baker?
Are we, are you getting an update on the bond transaction, just timing, or you're going in October, right?
So, once again, as we have told the board, talking about the timing or specifics of on transaction is a risky topic and something that we would not be prepared to do in a public meeting. We certainly do intend to give the board updates as we evaluate whether that the possibility of such a transaction and the timing of such a transaction. So we thought that would be something that we would bring to you at your next board meeting and probably in the form of a closed session.
Anyone else? John.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to focus on a couple of different things here. Mr. Brown brought up the fact that in many people's minds, both elected officials, appointed officials, and the general public, that this 4% pledge is like chipped in stone, like one of the commandments. And so but on the other hand, you recognize, we all recognize, that inflation is real. And if we want to keep these facilities and these projects going forward, we keep coming back closer and closer to the fact that 4% really can't make it work. And I'm sympathetic to the public out there, regardless of whether you're in Wayne County, or Macomb, or Oakland, or Flint, or Detroit, or wherever, that there's people that can afford to cover their water and sewer bills, and there's other people that are just really up against the wall, and we need to kind of keep that in mind. I particularly appreciate having this discussion today. We're going into a budget planning process. We're going into a situation where there's communities that are dealing with their own issues. We want to try to give them as much warning, I guess, as possible about what's happening. And that's what one of the things that I'm so, from my perspective, pleased with how the member partners are brought into it, the various leaders. There's been meetings with them where you try to, this is no surprise, and we need to keep doing that. And the comment that was made earlier by Director Brown about, you know, we have a bid from a contractor and the inflation is just sort of shot right through the roof about it. Someone else who bid, perhaps, would like another opportunity. And this gets very tricky. This is where Randall and Bill come in terms of looking at this from a legal perspective. We certainly don't want to step into something where we make a mistake that costs us money because the way we handle the bid. Everything needs to be, as you keep saying over and over, as transparent as possible. But I share Mr. Brown's view about trying really hard not to push past that 4%. And perhaps even if we need to get some kind of understanding with the public that it will be delayed 2 years, 3 years or so until we can see inflation drop down, wages continue to stabilize, perhaps go upward, so that then the 4%, we could juggle with that and perhaps get into a situation where it could be 4.5 or something along those lines, or graduate it in such a way that it isn't a big leap. But again, I really appreciate Nikki and Mr. Foster and the gentleman that was on the call earlier, how that was all presented today. Certainly something sobering for me to think about and to talk to the people I need to discuss this with and keep them posted.
Yeah, and clearly if we had not had this economic impact of the previous 3 years, when we had this conversation of exceeding 4%. And keep in mind, even when we talk about, well, inflation might not be as high, it's already up here. It's just whether it goes up here more or dips a little bit. But, you know, I think what we're experiencing is the cost reset in the capital program. And, you know, so all of those are good. You know, and ideally, you know, when I had my local utility hat on, we also did 5 and 10 year forecast, and we had a smoothed annual consistent increase so that there wasn't increases and decreases from year to year. And having that predictability is important for people for planning. So I'm sensitive to my colleagues who are in the shoes that I was in previously of trying to do multiple year budgets and plan. You know, and I think sometimes too, when we talk about affordability is what we immediately think of, but it's also managing the system so that we don't have a situation where we do have a spike. And I think that's what we're working with internally, is how can we smooth out the projects and the expenditures to try to meet that.
These graphs you provided are just so poignant, that going along all of a sudden,
right,
it takes off like that, and it's like, wow.
Yeah.
And that's what the leaders of all these communities need to see, and then help us to explain this to their constituents, who are our constituents, about, you know, because we have aging equipment, and if we neglect it, we don't make these improvements. Water side, wastewater side, and the whole issue about flooding, and which is in everybody's mind every time. There's a weather forecast about 2 inches or 3 inches of rain, maybe. I'm sure the people that have had floods are like, oh my, I better go deal with everything that I've got on the basement floor.
Right.
And also, but this was really very well done.
So, I'm not sure if there's other questions. I know our CEO is poised to wrap us up today when we're ready.
30 seconds.
Oh, no.
Or less. My friend John mentioned that deferred maintenance is not a cost savings. And this is a forum and conversation we should be having, because these are tough decisions. Obviously, a line by line review of the budget matters. That's a cost savings opportunity. But sometimes these strategies drive bad behaviors. I'm not saying that it's in this room, but as the Board of Trustees, we need to have these conversations to put off a repair. It's $20 million today, $50 million tomorrow is not a cost savings. And it is incumbent upon the team to push back and let us know the downside of those conversations as we talk through the numbers. So thank you for your transparency and for lifting those up to us.
So I appreciate that. I appreciate all the comments. I think these are tough conversations we have to have, and I'm glad that we were able to bring them to you this early in this this process. I think that was a very, Director Mullen, very, very poignant, because that is where we are, right? The GLWA knew and understood that it was taking on a tremendous amount of deferred maintenance and capital and pushing that capital out. And we have been working very, very diligently every single year to do everything we can to keep the charges low, right? We have a 4% promise. We're holding to the 4% promise. But the big dollar differences that you see, the assets still have those needs. And what you're seeing is us inching toward the end of the useful life of assets that have 60, 7,500 year useful lives. And that our average asset in the pipes, our pipes age 7,500 years, right there. So we are there. And if we do emergency repairs, number one, what happens is the service disruption is not just inconvenient. It is life-changing sometimes for people when we have water service disruption. So, and I don't sound this alarm very often. You don't hear me say this to this board very often, but I am telling you, we are at a point where we have to invest in these assets. We absolutely must. And so we've got to do whatever we've got to do to be affordable, and we're committed to that. We are people serving people. We are a bunch of public servants, you know, trying to do the right thing every single day. But we have got to fix these assets. We have got to renew them. So it is absolutely a necessity. There isn't a lot of wants here, right? This is just what we need to do. And so I appreciate the comments. I think we heard some creative things today about what might we do differently, what might we look at things differently to try to control costs. But the capital program needs to move forward, and it needs to move forward in a very robust manner, because in the end, the failures cost more than the repairs, and then the residents are not just inconvenienced, their lives are disrupted. So again, appreciate the fact that we had the conversation so early. I thought it was also a very good presentation. Thank you very much for it. And directors, thank you for your candor. We appreciate that, and that's the kind of input that we are looking for that we need.
Thank you, Sue. Anyone else? Nikki, you done?
I am done.
Okay, well then, moving on with the last couple of items on the agenda, which really isn't much.
Karen, because I'd like to
yes.
A motion to receive and file a report.
So moved.
Moved and supported. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
The motion passes. I guess I want to express our thanks to the Reverend Dr. Nicholas Hood III, who's a senior pastor and minister here at Plymouth United Church of Christ. Him, his staff, and all of the members of the church family for opening up their doors and allowing us to be here to host this meeting. I think I've been advised that there may be additional or subsequent meetings held at this venue, and for that we say thank you in advance. Any other remarks from board members? Mr. Wolfson, you got other matters?
There are no other matters, Mr. Chairman.
If not, I'll entertain a motion to adjourn the meeting.
Support.
Mr. Brown, Mr. Miller, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Motion passed. You are adjourned. Thanks, everybody.